I grew up in a little place called Kirby, Mississippi, and one of the defining moments of my youth was sneaking into a movie theater in nearby Roxy to see a movie called Sudden Impact. It's one of the Dirty Harry sequels, with Clint Eastwood playing the same character who, in the first movie, gives a criminal the whole "do you feel lucky" speech. The movie itself is nothing special, at least it can't hold a candle to the likes of Magnum Force, but it marked the first time that I found myself thinking, I want to be a cop. But not just any cop. I want to be a detective. Some foul-mouthed, rough-riding hammer of justice, just like old Dirty Harry Callahan. Well, real life isn't like the movies, and I had to learn to walk before I could run. But after working hard in school and putting in my time as a uniformed officer, I submitted an application to the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation. The MBI aren't strictly police, we're state special investigators, which comes with the freedom to run our investigations as we see fit, all while having the same investigative powers as regular law enforcement. Think of us like safeties on a football field. We can move wherever and however we want, just as long as we make the game-winning tackle. I worked in major crimes for a few years, mainly just making a name for myself within the Bureau. And then one day, in early April of 2003, my SSA, or supervisory agent, approaches me with an intriguing offer. The public safety commissioner had recently approached the MBI's chief, or the SAC as we like to call him, and asked him to put together a brand new unit. And this unit would be unlike any that had come before it and would focus on one and one task alone: reviewing and potentially reinvestigating what are referred to as cold cases. A lot of other states already had a dedicated cold case unit, but officially speaking, Mississippi didn't have one until the summer of 2004. But 18 months previous, the head of the DPS said that it was high time the Bayou State tasked some of its own officers with investigating unsolved crimes. And he gave the go-ahead for the pilot scheme that I was eventually a part of. I was honored to be considered for the job, but in the MBI, there's only one way to climb the career ladder, and that's to deliver noticeable and consistent results. Working at solving tough, long-dead cases would make for a noble pursuit. I just didn't know it was the right choice at such a formative stage of my career. Working cold cases seemed like a job for an old-timer, someone who had the patience and the experience to see things others didn't. But for me, I wanted to run with the big dogs. I wanted to be chasing down killers, kicking in doors, and then dragging them off to jail in cuffs. I didn't want to be trapped in the archives for 12 hours a day, getting paler and older with nothing to show for it. But according to my supervisory agent, all my hunger was exactly why he wanted me there. He believed that if I applied that same drive to unsolved crimes, I could potentially make my career there, and if the pilot scheme was successful and the unit expanded, I could end up getting promoted and running my very own team. Once he'd put my mind at ease like that, I accepted the invitation and put my name forward. Then, just a few weeks later, the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation's first ever cold case unit held its first official meeting in one of the conference rooms of our district headquarters. Essentially, our job was this. We had to go through stacks of unsolved case files, all pertaining to violent crime, then pick out any we thought had a chance of being solved. And after that, we had to take the case file over to the district attorney's office and see if they'd be willing to prosecute any suspects that we might identify. I guess that might sound obtuse to some people, who are thinking surely it's the DA's job to prosecute everyone they suspect of being guilty of a violent crime, right? And to that I say, sure, in theory, but that's not always how things work. A district attorney will sometimes tell you they serve justice, but in reality, they don't serve anyone except the people who elect them. I guess that's a good thing if you're looking at the bigger picture. It's still we the people, you know. But unless it's going to make a DA look good, they won't want to reach into the public purse for it, and I kind of get it. No good solving a 30-year-old double murder when there's an active child predator roaming the state, committing crimes in the here and the now. But this attitude made our job needlessly frustrating. The very purpose of the cold case unit's creation was to cut through all the red tape, but in practice, we ended up having to get our cases rubber stamped before we could even work them. However, whenever we did get that rubber stamp, if we had the evidence, the case file, and a viable suspect, then was all systems go. The first case I sent over to the DA involved a Jane Doe that had been found up in Marshall County back in 1993. Her body had been found by a guy that had pulled over to the side of the highway to take a leak. He stopped his truck, walked off into the trees to get a little privacy, and then noticed two hefty-looking trash bags lying near the base of a tree. The guy said that he figured some asshole was dumping trash and planning on tossing the bags into the back of his truck so he could dispose of them once he got back into town. But then as he got closer, he started to smell that very sickening but oddly familiar stench. The guy didn't take a step further towards those trash bags. He knew what was in them, because they smelled almost the exact same way as his old pet cat did after his parents pulled its maggot-infested corpse out of the crawl space below his childhood home. The guy drives back home, calls the cops, and tells them that he's got a real bad feeling about the two trash bags that he'd seen. And not long after, a highway patrol officer was taping off the scene in preparation for the arrival of the forensics teams. Jane Doe's body had been dismembered and then placed into two trash bags. Her torso and her arms were in one, her legs in the other, but her head, her hands, and her feet, they were all missing. She was estimated to be anywhere between the ages of 17 to 25 when she was murdered, while abrasions to her knees and lower back suggested that she made a living as a prostitute. There were track marks on her arms and puncture marks around her groin, which suggested a prolonged and habitual use of narcotics, but we had to wait for the toxicology report to find out just how extensive that drug use was. At the time of her death, Jane Doe had high levels of oxycodone and Demerol in her system, but also tested positive for cocaine, methamphetamine, and shockingly high amounts of synthetic psychedelic known as 2CB. During the investigation that followed, two of my fellow agents from Major Crimes isolated a trail of boot prints which led from the nearby highway to the disposal site and back again. They didn't belong to the truck driver that had found the trash bags, and they didn't belong to any of the MHP officers that had been the first to arrive at the scene. The boot prints from those size 12 Red Wings constituted one of the only pieces of workable evidence Major Crimes had to work with, but at the time, it was seen as a very important one. Red Wings were the favorite footwear of serial killer George Jones, who was already doing life for the murder of three hookers throughout the 80s and early 90s. Then, with Jane Doe's body being found in 1993, the case's original investigators believed that she was one of Jones's victims and had tried their best to pin it on him at his trial and back in 1998, I think. But after reviewing those case files, I noticed that there were two major inconsistencies between the murders in 1992 and 94, and my Jane Doe from the year between. First off, one of the pieces of evidence used to convict George Jones was his truck's tachometer. To put it into layman's terms, these measure how hard an engine is working, and Jones was used to prove that he'd lied regarding diversions from his assigned trucking route. But when it came to the Jane Doe murder, Jones's tachometer matched the route that he claimed to have been driving, one which took him far from Marshall County during the period of Jane Doe's body being believed to have been dumped. There was always the possibility that Jones had swapped his tachometer with someone else's in an attempt to cover his tracks, but if that was the case, why did he get smart for just one of the murders instead of all four? The second inconsistency involved the method of disposal. Victims from 92 and 94 had been mutilated extensively, but it was a wild, frenzied kind of mutilation, no rhyme or reason to it at all. But in the case of Jane Doe, the removal of her head, hands, and feet hadn't exactly been done with surgical precision, but they marked the only manner in which her body had been desecrated, and the dismemberment had only commenced following her murder. Jones, on the other hand, liked to start cutting his victims up while they were still alive, and unlike Jane Doe, his victims still had their fingers, toes, and teeth. At his trial, the prosecution painted the 93 murder as Jones's attempt to switch up his modus operandi, partly as a way of keeping himself entertained and partly as a way of throwing the cops off his scent. But his defense pointed to the tachometer evidence and made such a strong argument for his innocence that the jury only found Jones guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder and not the original 4. At that point, the DA was just happy to have gotten a conviction, and although Jane Doe's case was tossed in with the cold ones, it was believed that someone, at some point, would conclusively link her murder to George Jones, and the case could finally be closed. After all, Jones wore a size 12 Red Wing, exactly the same kind that left the boot prints at the scene. It had to be him, right? Same type of victim, same type of location, just a slight variation in the MO. Even if the jury couldn't see it, Major Crimes thought that they had their guy, so although Jane Doe's case file remained officially unsolved, no one felt too bad about tossing it into the cold case files, as the man who most probably killed her was set to rot in prison for the rest of his life. Now, here's where I bent the rules just a little bit. The DA would never have approved my reopening of the case until I had a viable suspect, and I heavily implied that I was going to be the one to finally bridge the investigative gap between Jones and Jane Doe. The only thing was, I didn't think Jones was our guy. Jones was a man of lukewarm IQ, who struggled with meth, prostitutes, and his own guilt. He could hide the meth use from his wife and kids, and he mistakenly thought that he could hide the infidelity, too. But in murdering the prostitutes he craved after his week-long meth binges, Jones took all his self-loathing out on those poor girls. He hacked and slashed and stomped on them, and he wanted to make them suffer for tempting him. But the way in which Jane Doe was dismembered, it was almost clinical. I knew it would be a risk to go out on a limb like that, but something about the way the case was dealt with the first time around, it just kinda irked me. Jane Doe was treated like a pawn in a game of chess, a throwaway piece in an otherwise successful prosecution, and I thought she deserved far better. So, I worked my ass off to get the case approved, then was finally allowed to start doing my job. My first call was over at the team at Missing Persons, and using their newly digitized record system, they were able to provide me with a list of young women and girls whose cases fit a fairly narrow criteria. The girls needed to be fair-haired, they needed to be between the ages of 17 and 25, and they needed to have been declared missing between the years of 1988 and 1993. From the looks of her body, Jane Doe had been a drug user and a prostitute for quite some time prior to her murder, so I asked the special agents at Missing Persons to factor that into their search. Sadly, prostitutes are rarely reported missing if they do happen to disappear, so all I could do was hope that someone, somewhere, missed Jane Doe enough to have filed a missing persons report. And once I had all my reports, all I had to do was set about contacting as many of the relevant families as possible to ask if their daughters had any distinguishing scars, tattoos, or birthmarks. I could then cross-reference these answers with autopsy photos that I had at my disposal, and hopefully, I'd be able to come up with an ID. It took days upon days of searching up phone numbers, asking for forwarding addresses and visiting people at home, but eventually, I ended up getting a hold of a mother who'd filed a missing persons report following her stepdaughter's disappearance back in 1991. The stepdaughter had come from her husband's first marriage, but she adored the girl like her own flesh and blood and was devastated when she went missing. The girl was a physical match for Jane Doe, and when I asked if she had any distinguishing marks or features on her body, her mother told me about a small scar just above the elbow on her right arm. The scar was the result of some childhood misadventure, and when I checked the autopsy photos, there it was. Jane Doe had a tiny scar just above her right elbow. Now, this wasn't some conclusive proof that Jane Doe was the same missing stepdaughter, as a person's arms are one of the most common places that scars will be present. But what would provide concrete proof of her relation, and therefore her identity, would be a DNA test. With it being her stepdaughter, there was no point testing the mother. There was no testing the father either, as he'd walked out in the family some years earlier, possibly due to the stress of his daughter's disappearance. However, the girl's father and her stepmother had their own daughter, meaning we could test her DNA in relation to Jane Doe's, and if we got anything back around a 25% match, then that'd be enough for Jane Doe to get her name back. I was very confident that test was going to come back positive. I mean, the chances of two different fair-haired young women having the exact same scar just above their elbow were astronomical. I showed the stepmother a cropping of the autopsy photo too, and she claimed to be 99% sure that the scar above her elbow belonged to her stepdaughter. But then, when the DNA results came back, it read, "No match." There was a 0% match between the two supposed half-sisters, which on the surface meant Jane Doe could not have been the woman's missing stepdaughter. If she was, and as I've already covered, the DNA test would have resulted in a match of around 25%, and needless to say, I was incredibly disappointed. I had such a strong hunch that Jane Doe was the missing stepdaughter, and so at first, those test results were a real hit to my confidence. If I had a picture of the stepdaughter's hand, something that I could use to compare those two scars, that would have been a game changer. But I didn't, and no offense to the stepmother, but I wasn't about to trust her very fallible memory over a black-and-white DNA test that read plain and simple, no match. I was forced to consider other options, so I carried on working and contacting the families of missing young women in the state of Mississippi. But every so often, I'd come back to the missing stepdaughter, wondering how in the hell such a sure thing had turned out to be a dud. And that's how, after thinking about it for a long time, I began to ask myself some very out-there questions. Namely, what if there was no match between the two half-sisters because the missing one wasn't actually her father's biological daughter from his first marriage? She was supposed to be from his first marriage, right? And her stepmother was given no reason to doubt what her husband was telling her. But then, what if that was a lie? At that stage, I had no idea why the father might lie about something like that, but there was at least one innocent explanation for it, in that our missing girl might have been adopted at an early age. Perhaps her adopted father didn't want her to know this, so he decided to keep it a secret until a more appropriate time. After all, he and his new partner chose to have a child together pretty quickly, and knowledge of their adoptive background might add strain to an already stressful situation. But then, what if there was some other reason why the father had lied about his first daughter's origins, one that wasn't nearly so wholesome? I asked the woman if she'd ever met her missing husband's first wife, and she said no, that she'd passed not long after giving birth to his daughter, and that her husband had claimed that the memory was so painful that he'd rather not revisit it. That's what prompted me to dig into the father's background a little, just to see if there was any adoption records in his name, but there wasn't a single document with the supposed father's name on it anywhere in the system. I then went back to the stepmother and asked if she'd held on to any of her husband's old documentation, particularly anything with his social security number on it. She said that there wasn't much in the way of documentation, but that she had his social security number written down somewhere. She thought that she might need it during the process of dividing up her deceased husband's estate, but it turned out that she hadn't needed to and was only too happy to pass it along to me. Once I had his social security number, I could run it through state adoption databases, and if it came back with a match of him adopting a girl of Jane Doe's age, then my theory was back on track. But frustratingly, it didn't come back a match. But during the process of investigating the social security number, I discovered something which broke the case wide open. The social security number did not match the name of the missing father, and instead, an entirely different name came back when I ran it through the state's computer system. I knew I was onto something the moment a different name came back, but this name didn't match any in the state's adoption records either. However, the name had a criminal history attached to it, and while it was a very brief one, it was very significant to the investigation. The criminal history included one count of indecent exposure and one count of attempted kidnap on a minor. According to my timeline, this guy does just 6 of an 11-year sentence for attempted kidnapping and then just disappears. Then, about a year later, a man matching his exact physical description shows up on the other side of the country with a little girl telling everyone it's his biological daughter. I made sure to get a look at some photos of the missing father, too, and he was an exact match for the mugshots of our pederast. I spoke to the stepmother extensively regarding the manner in which her stepdaughter disappeared, and she told me it wasn't an overnight thing. Her stepdaughter's relationship with her father had soured dramatically over the final few months before she vanished, so at first, it was believed that she'd simply run away from home. She was recently 18 at the time, and seeing as she was a legal adult, she was free to do as she pleased. Her father claimed that he was attempting to bring her back home, but eventually, contact with her began to wane before ceasing altogether. The stepmother mentioned how difficult it was to get her husband to file a missing persons report. She said that reporting her missing felt like a defeat for him, that acknowledging she was in danger made him feel like he'd failed as a father. It took many months for him to concede, but eventually, they filed a report with the Hattiesburg Police Department. The move seemed to crush him, and around 6 months afterwards, he walked out on both his wife and his younger daughter, leaving only a note which read, "I'm sorry." I asked when this was, if she could remember the date of her husband's departure. She told me it was on August of 1993, Friday the 13th to be exact. She remembered it like it was yesterday. And in the seconds after she mentioned the date, I felt a thought hit me right between the eyes, like a diamond-tipped bullet of realization. Jane Doe's body was found on Saturday, August 14th, 1993, the very next day after this woman's husband had mysteriously departed. It was him that had made her disappear, him that had killed her, and him that had dumped her body at the side of the highway. I walked out of that woman's home with a poker face that could have rivaled a million-dollar professional. The hunch that her missing husband had murdered her stepdaughter in a move prompted by the filing of that missing person's report, it gave me one of the strongest hunches I had ever felt in all my career in law enforcement. But in the moment, when she told me the date of his sudden departure, I simply could not bring myself to tell her what I honestly thought. She had this whole tragic narrative built up around her family, one that came with a cross that she had to carry wherever she went, and I couldn't bear to add any more of that to the load. If she is to find out the truth, it should be via the proper channels, and it should be based on concrete judicial results, not what, at the time, were still nothing but half-baked theories so convoluted that I felt like I was losing my mind. And how do you even begin to tell someone that her husband married her under an assumed identity, that his so-called daughter might have been a kidnap victim, and that not only was he a potential suspect in her disappearance, but also her eventual murderer, too? I think just one of those things would be enough to send a woman like that into shock-induced catatonia, but all four at once, I figured that might kill a person dead if you caught them in the wrong mood with it. Since I had no viable suspects, there was no point in taking any of my findings to the district attorney, but there was a whole lot of point in taking what I'd found to the MBI's Major Crimes Unit, as well as several other organizations, including the FBI, the U.S. Marshals Service, the National Crime Information Center, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. If we were potentially looking at a nationwide manhunt for a soon-to-be fugitive, then there was only so much state authorities were capable of, and if the father had in fact fled the country, then it was well and truly out of our hands. After that, I simply reclosed the case, placed it back in the stack with all the other cold ones, and then went about trying to find one that would result in an actual conviction and not just an entry on the FBI's Most Wanted website. The cold case unit was set up to close cases and get results, ideally in cases where investigators were just a few short yards from making the touchdown. All I could do was hope that someone up the federal chain took interest enough to find our suspect, extradite him back to Mississippi, and then put him on trial for murder. But to date, that hasn't happened. I worked on a bunch more cases, some good, some bad, but I never heard back about the Marshall County Jane Doe, and I never shared my thoughts or feelings with her stepmother. Like I said, it wouldn't feel right putting that kind of weight on her, especially when it all just amounted to theories. I work in the state's Criminal Information Center now, doing something much slower and much less taxing than working old cold cases. I miss my time with the unit, They seem like they were the good old days before I really realized that they truly were the good old days. But I don't miss cases like Jane Doe's, because that's impossible. To miss something, you have to leave it behind. It has to disappear or change in some way. But Jane Doe's life, her death, her story, they'll always be with me. I've accepted that now. And as much as I'd like to see her killer brought to justice before I go back to God, I've also accepted that for some folks, justice is a luxury they'll simply never get to enjoy. My name is Andrew. I'm from Widnes in northwestern England, and I'm a huge fan of the channel, particularly the dedicated true crime videos that you upload from time to time. And I'm really interested in the subject of criminality, and although I've never worked within the police service, I've been involved in private security investigation for the last 22 years. You see, here in England, you don't really need any policing experience to become a PI. All you have to do is obtain a license from the Security Industry Authority, attend the relevant training courses, and boom, you're free to start practicing as a fully licensed private investigator. Now don't get me wrong, I'd considered becoming a police officer for quite some time, but when push came to shove, the antisocial hours and shockingly low wages had me considering many other options. I worked odd jobs for a few years, just kind of mulling over what I'd wanted to do in my life, and in my late 20s, I came up with the idea to get into private investigations. My first job was essentially a low-paid 12-month-long apprenticeship, but since my income was supplemented by the Department of Work and Pensions, it wasn't like I was having to pinch every penny in order to get by. I used those 12 months to advance my knowledge of the trade, and my boss was a former member of the Criminal Investigation Department, meaning he had an awful lot of skill and experience to pass on. I mostly shadowed him during that first year, helping out on the clerical side of things, running small errands and making copious cups of tea. I wasn't massively hands-on at first, but by the end of the 12 months, I was being treated as a capable member of the investigations team, and that led to a formal job offer at the end of the apprenticeship. I wasn't immediately trusted to take cases on of my own. I still operated as part of the team and mostly under the direct guidance of more senior investigators. But as that learning process continued, the trust that was placed on me grew and grew until finally the time came for me to start working cases on my own. In the years that followed, I worked a lot of very depressing and very stress-inducing cases. I also worked my fair share that I described as boring, too. But out of all of them, there was only one that ever really frightened me, and I'm talking like properly terrified, too, not just a little bit anxious. And that case was this one I'm about to tell you. So one day, the firm I worked for got a call from a woman whose grown-up son had been missing for just under a year. He'd originally disappeared for around 4 months, then his mom had gotten a text message from his phone saying that he was okay, but wanted a new start elsewhere. He said he was sorry for upsetting people, but that it was just something that he had to do, and that he'd be in touch whenever he could. The woman said that she knew her son had gone through a difficult patch, but that she was devastated by the news of his sudden and unexpected departure. It wasn't completely out of character either. He'd run away from home as a teenager to try and live with his biological father, but had come straight home when he saw the reality of how he lived. He'd also run away to sleep on a friend's spare mattress back when he was a younger teenager too, so it wasn't like just absconding was completely out of character for him. The trouble came when his mom tried calling him to talk on the phone. At first, she said that she understood him not wanting to talk because he said the sound of her voice would make him too emotional. But then as time went by, his refusal to talk on the phone got very suspicious. She'd already been in touch with the police by that time, and her son was officially a missing person when he got back in touch. But then the moment she informs the police that she's been in contact with her son, he gets taken off the missing person's register. But the mom jumped the gun. She was so eager to share the good news that she didn't think to do the legwork in terms of confirming it really was her son. And by the time she realized that something dodgy was going on, she had to get back in touch with the police, who by that time seemed to be convinced that it was all a load of family melodrama. She had to call them half a dozen times just to get them to refile the missing persons report, and even then, they clearly weren't taking her very seriously. It took months for the police to get back to her, and when they did, they said that her son's phone had pinged off some mobile towers in the area and had started doing so a few nights a week around 4 months into his disappearance. His mom was shown on a map where this area was, and she was asked what reason she thought that he had to be in that area, and she had no idea. The police then went looking around this area and found it to be a small junction with a few shops and a pub. Officers asked the patrons of each if they'd seen the bloke, and although people in the kebab and bedding shops had no idea who or where he was, some of the patrons of the pub said that they had seen him around the bar a few times in the past. They had no idea when, they just said that he looked familiar and that they'd definitely seen him sitting at the bar, drinking a pint of lager from time to time. This was good news on the surface, but as the police rightly said, the woman's son wouldn't be taken off the missing persons register until someone had physical, face-to-face contact with him. Getting him on the phone would be ideal, but even so, it didn't exclude the possibility of him being in danger somehow. Modern-day slavery is still very much a thing in cities across the UK, and it might not be as plain and obvious as you might expect. So even if her son assured her that he was okay, the police told the mom to keep on texting and trying to call him until her son gave up his location. And in the meantime, officers from their missing persons team would keep looking for him, but more and more time went by and they didn't seem to have any results. In the end, the woman was told that although her son's case would obviously remain open, with his picture and profile on their website, the police would be diverting resources away from the search for her son. They weren't abandoning the case, not by any stretch of the imagination, but the fact was that there were more urgent cases that needed their immediate attention. One of the missing persons team would revisit the case from time to time, but apart from that, there was only so much they could do. And that's where I entered the situation, when my boss assigned me the job of tracking down this woman's son. Since the last place he seemed to have been sighted was the pub the police had mentioned, I thought I'd better start there so I could chat with some of the patrons. I'm not quite sure what I was expecting, to be honest. All I knew was that it was a pub. But let me tell you, there are family pubs, old man pubs, and then there are pubs like the one I had to visit when I was working this case, and they are not the kind of place you'd take your kids for Sunday lunch. I've been to a fair few dodgy pubs in my time, but this one took the biscuit. The police had apparently told the lad's mother that the people drinking in the pub were very cooperative, but when I visited, I realized that they must have been on their best behavior. First of all, the second I turned into the little courtyard, this group of four lads who were standing outside smoking stopped talking, turned to look at me, and then studied me silently and carefully as I passed them. I gave them a quick, "All right, lads," but they didn't return the greeting. They just kept on eyeing me up intimidatingly as I pulled the pub's door open and walked inside. There was almost a repeat performance as I walked up to the bar. Not exactly a record scratch moment where everyone turned around to look at me, but I felt enough eyes to feel a smidge of stage fright as I walked up to the bar and ordered a lemonade. The first thing the barmaid asked me was, "Are you a copper?" And in all fairness, I not only ordered like one, but I look like one too since I was dressed in my work suit. I told her no, that I wasn't a cop, but that I was there to ask a few questions if she had the time to talk. She didn't look best pleased at this answer, but said that she'd help as best she could, if she could. I showed her the picture of the lad that I was looking for, and after studying it for a second or two, she told me that yes, she recognized him, but she hadn't seen him in a few months. However, she added that she wasn't the only barmaid who worked there, and that the others might have seen him more recently than she. And after that, I started making my way round the pub, talking to individuals or groups and not having much joy at all. Most said that they had no idea who the lad was. Others said he looked familiar, but they couldn't remember when he'd been in or what his name was. I thanked everyone for their time, even the ones who told me to F off or decided to take the piss, and then eventually, I got around to this big table of five blokes, and thankfully, they actually seemed keen to help. They all looked to be in their 40s and 50s, the kind of salt-of-the-earth working-class blokes that you'd expect to see in any kind of pub. Only there was something different about this group. This was around 6 in the morning when I popped in, and almost everyone else in the pub was either wearing their dirty work uniforms, think builders or painters, or very casual tracksuits or training gear, which tends to be the uniform of the northern working class. But then these blokes sat around the larger table were almost all wearing luxury designer clothing. Stone Island, Barbour, Moncler, and Saint Laurent. They were all wearing stuff like that, and how do I put this? Suspiciously expensive in light of where they were drinking. It wasn't exactly in your face either, and the untrained or unfashionable eye might not have picked it up. But I did, and it immediately captured my interest. I didn't say anything about their clothing, I just showed them the picture of the lad that was missing and asked if they'd seen him or knew him. And they knew him all right, but only by reputation. One of the blokes said something to the effect of, "Look, mate, I don't want to grass this kid up, but he was on all kinds of drugs, and he was always getting himself into trouble. If he disappeared, he probably owes someone money, and that person is probably a drug dealer. You find the dealer, and you find the lad. That's the way I see it, anyway." And the rest of the blokes seemed to agree with this, although they didn't talk nearly as much as the shorter bloke in the Stone Island jumper and the salt-and-pepper hair, whose mates seemed content to let him talk for them. I then asked if the missing lad had been into the pub in the past few weeks, and they said no. But I followed up by asking if anyone had seen him in the pub on the exact date, one which his mobile carrier had confirmed that he was in the area on. And they said no again. They hadn't seen him on that date, and they'd remember because it was on a Saturday and they'd been in the pub all day. Once they'd answered my questions, I thanked them, and then I sat down at a free table to finish my drink as I continued to subtly people-watch. One of the other things I noticed about the pub was that toilet visits were very frequent, and while that might not be unusual in a place that sells alcohol, seeing lads go off to the toilet in pairs was a dead giveaway that there was drug use occurring. But in contrast to all the people going in and out of the toilets, and then walking out looking like they'd just sucked the juice out of a car battery, the group of five well-dressed older blokes didn't move. The only time they interacted with anyone was when this rough-looking lad walked up to them, asked them something quietly, then got a series of intense stares from the group before he seemed to apologize and walk away. After I spoke to everyone I could, I sat there at the bar, subtly people watching until I finished my lemonade. And then after that, I walked out of the pub after thanking the barmaid, but on the way out, just as I got into the little smoking area out the front, a woman asked if I had a spare cigarette. I told her I didn't smoke, and then she asked me if I had any spare change. But instead of turning her down, I asked her to take a walk with me so I could get some money out of a cash machine to give her. As we were walking, she asked if I wanted any business. And for those that are unaware, that's a phrase that the ladies of the night use to ask potential Johns if they'd like to buy their services. And this might sound a bit insensitive of me, but the second I heard that, I knew that I was going to be able to get some information out of her. She definitely was a user, and hard drugs, too, like heroin and crack, not a bit of puff like the inside of that pub stunk of. And that meant that she'd tell me anything I bloody well asked her if it meant getting enough money for a fix. Bearing in mind, you have to make it clear that if they give you accurate info, there'll be more money in it for them down the line, and that you'll be checking everything they tell you to make sure that they're a reliable source. A junkie would say anything to get money for drugs, but the prospect of getting more and more money off of you in the future, that puts a much more honest tongue in their mouths, let me tell you. Anyway, I told her all of that, and said that I'd give her 20 quid then and another 20 if I found out the info was reliable. If she sat in that pub, watched and listened, and then told me everything significant she'd seen and heard, then I'd give her even more money if that info proved reliable, and so on and so forth. Obviously, she was delighted at the prospect, and answered all my initial questions with this being what she told me. My early suspicions that the five well-dressed blokes were significant players in the local drug scene were correct. Although they never did any of the actual dealing, they left that to some underlings who hung around the pub too. The missing lad used to come in and buy drugs, and the last time the junkie girl had ever seen him, some kind of set-to or argument had taken place between him and one of the mid-level dealers. I asked her if she'd ever mentioned this to anyone else, and she said no. The only other person that had asked her had been a policeman, and she'd been in the pub at the time, so she kept shtum and claimed that she hadn't seen the missing lad. And as you can imagine, that made for a huge find. No one had ever mentioned the missing lad having any kind of disagreement with anyone before. And as any detective worth his salt will tell you, people like that, as in people they've had arguments with, are exactly the kind of people that you want to talk to after a certain person goes missing. The only trouble was, I'd already been sniffing around there once, and I could tell people hadn't acted as naturally as they would have been acting if I wasn't around to see them. I'd blown my cover, basically, which in any other situation might have been a big mistake. But I had my mole on the inside, my eyes and ears, and I just had to hope the information that she provided me with was as accurate as I hoped it would be. I took her phone number, told her what to do, then kept in touch with her by text message over the days that followed. She knew what her job was, and I passed along one crucial instruction. Don't go asking about the guy who gone missing. Don't go asking anything at all, for that matter. All she needed to do was keep her ears open and watch out for any unusual or suspicious behavior. When we parted, I wasn't planning on checking in with her for a couple of days, you know, to hopefully let some info mount up. But just a few hours later, she gave me a call. She told me the well-dressed blokes had been talking about me. They hadn't said a lot, but they had been talking about me. I asked what had been said, and she told me exactly what had happened. In the last half hour before the pub closed for the night, another well-dressed person had popped in and joined the others for a quick pint. My mole was at the bar, sitting side on as to not draw suspicion, but she was listening into everything they had to say. When the most recent arrival sat down, there was a brief exchange of greetings, and then one of them says in a low voice, "There's a fella been round asking about you-know-who." And the newest arrival asked, "Stick to the story." Then one of the others just nodded, and that was that, and they changed the subject afterwards. I asked if they said anything else the rest of the night, and my mole said no, so as much as I was grateful for the information, it wasn't much of use to me besides confirming my suspicions that they were somehow involved in the missing lad's disappearance. The girl asked for more money, and I said that I'd give her some, but only in a few days so she had a chance to do some more earwigging, and she agreed, but said that she wanted proper compensation for her time, to which I reluctantly agreed. A few days later, I gave her a call, hoping that she'd have a few more tidbits to give me, but to my deep disappointment, she didn't. She basically told me that she'd been trying her best, had stuck to my rule of not asking questions herself, but she hadn't heard a single thing related to either me or the missing persons case I was investigating. And like I said, I was disappointed, but I told her that if she did manage to hear anything, that she was still welcome to give me a call. But that was not what she wanted to hear. She started to give me this sob story about how she needed money, how she could have been off earning, but had instead been sitting in the pub acting like a spy for me. And she did raise a point. If I wasn't giving her money for drugs, she'd be off earning the money for them elsewhere. So as much as it wasn't very ethical of me to do so, I arranged to meet with her so I could give her some cash. A few hours later, I'm sitting in an Aldi car park, waiting for this girl to turn up, and when she does, she's very happy to see me. I gave her 50 quid, told her to keep up the good work, and then said that I'd call her in a couple of days. At the time, I appreciated the fact that she was brutally honest with me. She could have easily made something up just to get some more money, but she hadn't, and as she was about to get out of my car, I told her as much. I mentioned there'd be a bonus in it for her if she found me anything particularly juicy, and then instead of pushing the car door all the way open and climbing out, she closed it again and turned back towards me. She started to say how there was something that she'd noticed in the past few days, but that it was so small that she didn't think it was worth mentioning. I reminded her not to make anything up, and she swore that she wasn't, so I asked her to continue. She said that the bloke in the Stone Island jumper that had done all the talking, he was shorter than the rest with close-cropped salt-and-pepper hair, always had about 2 or 3 phones on him, as drug dealers tend to do. But whichever phone he used, there was always top-of-the-line iPhone or Samsung-type things, and he was never shy about using them in public. She said sometimes he'd be talking on one, and then typing messages into the other, bold as brass, but then that previous day, she'd spotted him using an old flip phone, and he'd been usually shy about doing so. Now, obviously, this was crucial information. Someone was acting out of the ordinary, and they were trying to be subtle about it, too. The girl said she wouldn't have noticed if I wasn't literally paying her to watch people on the sly, and that she didn't think a new phone was worth mentioning until she saw the way the guy acted while using it. I reminded her that this was exactly the kind of information I wanted to know, and then gave her a few extra quid on top of that after she assured me what she was saying was the truth. And on the drive home, I slowly began to piece things together. I realized there was a very good chance that the old flip phone belonged to my missing person, and the dealer had been trying to use it to fool the mum into thinking that her son was alive and well. If I was a police officer, I could get a warrant, walk into the pub, and search him on the spot. But there was absolutely no way of me being able to do that as a PI, so instead I had to think outside the box. First thing I did was get in touch with the missing lad's mum, and then ask if her son had been in touch with her in the last couple of days. She said that she hadn't heard from him in weeks, and he still refused to answer any phone calls. But from where I was standing, the dealer could have been using the missing lad's low-tech phone to assure other people, for example friends and other family members, that he didn't need to be looked for. Basically, I still thought that I was onto something, so I stopped shaving for a week, dug out some much more casual clothes, then decided to start visiting the pub every now and then to watch the well-dressed suspected dealers at their table of 5. I've had the missing lad's number since way back when I first took the case, and I tried calling it a few times myself, but one of 3 things tended to happen. Either the phone didn't ring at all, it rang all the way to the answering machine, or someone actively declined it. But this gave me an idea. Every so often, I'd stop by the pub sporting my civilian clothes, baseball cap, and my scruffy facial hair, sit inconspicuously in a corner, and keep my eye on the table of 5. I only ever did this during peak hours, so as not to draw too much attention to myself, but every time I did, I'd take out my phone, bring up the missing lad's number, and call it while covertly watching the table of dealers. I must have done this 5 or 6 times, with each call going straight to voicemail. But then one night, the phone actually started to ring. I didn't have my phone right up by my ear, I had it out of sight, but I could see it still saying dialing instead of connecting and going to voicemail, so I looked over at the table of dealers. Lo and behold, the little fellow with salt and pepper hair reaches into his pocket, looks at something tucked away in there out of sight, and when I looked back at my mobile, the call had gone to voicemail. The screen had gone from dialing to the little clock that counts how long a phone call had been, so I hung up the call and then tried again. And once again, the smaller fella reaches into his jacket, but that time, he takes something out of his pocket instead of just looking at it. And then just like I was, he holds the phone just under the table out of sight, and then puts it back into his pocket again. Not only had my second call been declined, but the third didn't connect at all. He turned off the missing lad's phone right there in front of me. A minute later, I was sat in my car trying desperately to get in touch with the detective in charge of the police investigation. I had her work mobile and I knew that she worked weekends, but this was 8:30 in the evening on a Saturday, so all I got was her voicemail too. I left her a message saying I had something very important to talk to her about, and that I'd get in contact with her again on Monday morning just so I'd be sure to catch her. She called me back the following afternoon, and when she did, I told her everything that I'd seen in the pub. I then made my theory abundantly clear to her, that something terrible had happened to our missing lad, and that this one particular dealer was using his phone to convince people that he was alive. The reports of him being seen in the pub following his disappearance were false, and had been issued by those responsible for his disappearance, and in all probability, this poor lad's murder. The detective knew about the missing lad's drug use, but somehow, the first lot to investigate hadn't put two and two together regarding his disappearance, and those that were essentially using the pub as a base of operation. The pub had been treated as a place the police might find the missing lad, when in reality, it was the very place he went missing. I honestly felt like I'd cracked the case, and at first, the detective seemed to find what I'd discovered to be very compelling. But then, cut to about 3 weeks later, and I called her back to see how things were progressing, and they hadn't moved an inch. The police weren't prepared to swoop in on a bloke just because he owned an old flip phone, especially when the missing lad might have swapped it for drugs prior to his disappearance. She also told me that if the guy was pretending to be this woman's missing or dead son, that was an extremely cruel thing to do, but there was no law in the land against it. It didn't even constitute harassment, since the guy obviously wasn't making sustained attempts to contact the missing lad's mother, and unless he tried to scam her out of money or something in that vein, there was no chance of doing him for fraud either. The guy was a scumbag, there was no doubt about that. He was profiting from the misery of others, but that didn't put him on the radar of missing persons or CID, not for the time being, anyway. It felt like a punch to the gut, though. All that work, dismissed like it was some harebrained theory that I just pulled out of my arse. The people involved in this lad's disappearance, whether it was murder, false imprisonment, or just threatening him into vanishing, they were sat right there in that scabby little pub, day after day, and it was a complete injustice. In an ideal world, the police could just turn their homes upside down, find the phone and any other evidence linking them to the lad's disappearance, and then throw the bloody book at them. But sadly, that's not the world we live in. Instead, we live in the world where I had to give a terrified mother my honest assessment, and it was one that left her completely bereft. I didn't tell her that I thought her son was dead, just that I was confident something bad had happened to him, and that the well-dressed men in the pub were somehow responsible. She thanked me through tears, then our time working at her behest came to a close. Of all the cases I've worked, that's the one that stuck with me the most, and I'd like to think it's obvious as to why that is. I was so close, so bloody close to finding out what happened to that guy, and the fact that we just had to stop where we did and walk away hoping the police would do something, it made me so frustrated that, at the time, I wanted to rip my hair out. It still makes me angry to think about, even all these years later, and I hope that maybe, just maybe, I'll read about it in the paper or hear about it in the news. I know I won't get any credit if the police finally do solve that case, but I'm not asking for any. I just hope that one day, a missing lad's mother gets the answers that she so richly deserves. First off, I'm Terry, and I'm from a place called Pleasant Prairie in Wisconsin, and I've been a subscriber since way back when you did Graveyard Shift stories. I love your videos, and I've always wanted to contribute in some way. I've just never had anything sufficiently scary happen to me that would warrant writing it down. Don't get me wrong, I'm very grateful for that, but I always felt kind of guilty for listening to so many stories from other people without ever really offering up one myself. But that's when I got an idea. If I didn't have any of my own experiences to write about, I'd just write about somebody else's. Now, I didn't go knocking on doors and begging people to tell me their most traumatic and terrifying experiences. I just told myself that I would wait for the right opportunity. If I ever heard a story, account, or a little anecdote that was submission-worthy, I'd ask the person's permission, write down as many notes as possible, and then send it over to you in the hopes that the story makes it into a video someday. Well, my plan finally came to fruition this past Christmas when a trip to visit some extended family resulted in a chance meeting with an older cousin I'm related to by marriage. So I have a very large extended family, and I won't be so verbose as to give you an entire family tree, but I still occasionally meet relatives for the very first time. A distant aunt and I were talking when she introduced me to a much older second cousin, twice removed, I say cousin. The guy was old enough to be my grandpa, but I guess by the laws of family trees, he was technically my cousin. But for the sake of simplicity and my own personal sanity, I'll just call him my uncle. I said hi, and then as I was making my introductions, my aunt had this light bulb moment and told my uncle that I was interested in serial killers and the like. I thought that was kind of a weird way to introduce myself, so I gave my aunt a look as if to say, "Why on earth did you mention that?" It's true, I do have interest in true crime, but then so did my uncle, because for 50 years he'd worked as a Wisconsin state patrolman and then a private eye just prior to his retirement. I think I could have exploded with happiness right there. I had no idea that I had any family that were former law enforcement, so I was very excited to talk to him about his time as a patrolman. It didn't occur to me right away that I could maybe coax a story or two out of him, but by the time we got to talking about some of the most memorable experiences, I knew it was only a matter of time before I plucked up the courage to ask, "What was the scariest or creepiest thing you encountered during your time in law enforcement?" I had a pretty good feeling that whatever he was going to tell me would be sufficiently intense to write a story about. I mean, you don't put half a century into something like law enforcement and not come across a few severely messed up things in that time. But what he proceeded to tell me scared me more than I ever could have imagined, and it came from just about as far from left field as I could have ever have guessed. So when I first asked, he gave a sigh before this very thoughtful look came over his face, like there were so many incidents that he couldn't possibly just choose one. He started out by telling me about a couple of bad car accidents he'd seen, the kind where the happy-go-lucky family of four get annihilated, while the drunk who sent them rolling into a ditch in flames walks away with nothing but a few cuts and bruises. Then he told me about a few murder scenes that he'd been unfortunate enough to have come across, like the guy who had his arms nailed to a wall so the people he stole from could torture him to death. He said it was the worst thing he'd ever seen, turned his stomach. But disgust and, by extension, horror are very different emotions to fear, he explained. My uncle said that when he was a state patrolman, there wasn't much that scared him. Everywhere he went, he was armed, and if he ever got into trouble, a few words into his radio would have a small army showing up with some shotguns and rifles. He said he was apprehensive of violent criminals, but he was able to defend himself, and most importantly, he had a badge and all that backup to deter anyone from messing with him. And that all went away when he became a private investigator. He was able to stay armed, but that's all he had. And if he got into any trouble, his only option was to call 911 just like a private citizen and hope some of his old coworkers got to him in time. He said the closest he probably ever came to losing his life was when some cheating husband figured out that he was being watched after he accidentally honked his horn one night while on surveillance. His target, who seemed to be a naturally paranoid person, became extremely agitated upon hearing that honk. He came down with his pistol and pointed it right in my uncle's face. He had to swear on his life that he'd been waiting for a friend, had fallen asleep in his car, then had accidentally leaned on his horn when he woke up again, which incidentally was sort of what actually did happen. I guess the truth of it showed in his face because, following a moment of clarity, the man lowered his gun and told my uncle to make himself scarce before he woke up the whole neighborhood. He was quite certain that if the unfaithful husband had suspected him of being some kind of private eye, he'd have been shot right there and then. People who believe they're being stalked can become very volatile, and I believe they'd been poking that particular bear for weeks before the pistol-pointing incident. But still, that wasn't the incident that had scared my uncle the most. What scared him more than anything was something that happened when he was working as a private investigator. He said that just after his retirement, he was so bored that he figured that he had a few more years of work in him, and since private investigation companies tend to offer competitive salaries based on previous experience, he figured that he could pad his bank account a little before spending his twilight years fishing off the coast or whatever he wanted to do. But then, as I already mentioned, certain moments in his brief career as a private eye was far scarier than anything he encountered with the state patrol. And so, at one point, the family of an unsolved murder victim approached the company that he was working for. The victim was murdered in downtown Milwaukee back in 1983, and then her body had been dumped off a bridge. My uncle took the job of reinvestigating the murder around 2013, so it had been a cold case for almost 30 years by that point. The owner of the PI company was an ex-Milwaukee PD, so he told my uncle to drop his name when asking to see the case files, and that would ensure they didn't just tell him to get lost. And so he calls Milwaukee PD, asks them for the files, and after making sure he's not just some crazy person, the police department ensures they'll get back to him once they dug out the files. A few days go by, and he hears nothing back, then a few days turns into a week, and then 2 weeks, and he's still not heard back from the PD about the case file. In the end, my uncle gets impatient and calls the department again to ask how the search for the files is going. He manages to get the officer he spoke to first on the line, and then, after a minute or two of talking, but not saying very much, the officer puts him on hold and then goes to get his boss. My uncle is wondering what the holdup is, then some Milwaukee PD captain picks up the phone and explains that they can't find the file that he's referring to. This captain then asks my uncle if he's sure that he's in touch with the correct department, and that he's happy to put him in touch with the right people if that's what the problem is. My uncle then checks some of his notes and then replies that there's been no mistake, and that the files should most definitely have been with the PD and not some smaller sheriff's department in the surrounding counties. The captain then says they'll check again, and that they'd call him back in a few days' time. But again, they seem to totally forget about finding the file, and my uncle is forced to call for a third time over this one little case file that it should have been really easy to find. And anyway, that third time, he gets told something pretty shocking. The department had misplaced this unsolved murder case file, meaning my uncle had no choice but to wait until they were found before he could see the case file in this one particular murder. He had to go back to his boss, tell him the cops had lost their case file, and his boss relays this to the family in turn. Without their daughter's case file, the company would have to start their own brand new investigation based on a murder that happened 30 plus years ago, which, if it isn't obvious, could be either totally impossible or would cost the family tens of thousands of dollars in investigation fees. As you can imagine, the family were not happy that the cops had lost their kid's case file, and my uncle said that he was pretty sure they started legal proceedings against the department, being a case of find your kid's case file or we'll sue the pants off of you. My uncle goes to work other cases, then goes into full retirement a few years later. Then, not long after that, he reads a headline in the Green Bay Gazette that went something a little like this: Milwaukee police destroy DNA murder evidence. He told me that when he saw the headline, he thought to himself, there's no way they destroyed evidence, let alone case files. But they had. Sometime in the 90s, someone up the chain of command in the Milwaukee PD got the bright idea to destroy around 50 evidence files because they needed more room for storage. And here's a link to an article I found to save you some time, and I'll pull some of the relevant quotes so you can see what I mean about their excuse being lack of storage. So basically, sometime in the mid-1990s, the Milwaukee PD ran out of space to store evidence files, so they had to schedule a bunch for destruction. But then the only files that should have been marked for destruction were files from solved cases, not unsolved ones. But then somehow a bunch of unsolved murder files got in there and were destroyed on accident. And what's worse, they had no idea which files had been destroyed or how many boxes. Since the scandal broke in mid-2018, everyone responsible for the destruction of the evidence had long since retired, but the Milwaukee PD were in touch with all the families of the affected victims to offer their apologies. But then, this is where things start to get really shady. First off, their excuse for destroying files was that there was no more space, but then a bunch of those cardboard storage boxes cost just a few dollars, so why did they need to destroy files in the first place? The Milwaukee PD didn't even bother to tell anyone that they were doing it either, and when they gave that excuse of them not having enough room, one guy said that he was flabbergasted by it, and that it was something that always bothered him. And it bothered my uncle, too, when he first heard about it, He'd had law enforcement experience, remember? And he knew that every department destroyed old evidence files. Heck, he'd done it a few times himself, too, but never without a careful process of selecting and reviewing the files that had been marked prior to their disposal. The idea they might destroy evidence from a cold case when such cases would doubtlessly be reopened and re-examined was a very scary prospect. So the idea that the boys over in Milwaukee acted with such complete incompetence that they didn't even bother to check what they were doing, it was unbelievable, but in the truest sense of the word. I also personally find it extremely suspicious that the Milwaukee PD just didn't seem interested in holding those responsible to account. I understand all of the top brass from the time the files were destroyed would have all been in their 70s or 80s or whatever, but still, the department just shrugged their shoulders like it was an honest mistake. And to be perfectly frank, a whole lot of people, myself included, think there wasn't an honest damn thing about it. They had to pick out those case files individually, and they had to do it by hand. It's not like they accidentally selected delete all or whatever, like there's a danger of doing when dealing with email inboxes and the like. They had to pick out each one, take a look at it, and then toss it in the pile marked to be destroyed. The way my uncle put it, either they had guys working for them that were too dumb to be allowed outside, or a bunch of corrupt police officers deliberately marking unsolved cases for destruction. I don't know if it makes me an eternal optimist or a rotten cynic, but I just don't believe that there are people walking around who are really that dumb. And I really hate to sound like some kind of conspiracy theorist, but I can't help but think that the unsolved murder files selected for destruction had something in common, or at least something about them that someone didn't want people to know about. Think about it. DNA evidence becomes a thing. Then, what do you know? A whole bunch of case files go missing, almost like someone didn't want their evidence being scrutinized by such a new, novel, but reliable technique. I thought it was kind of an odd answer at first. After all, my uncle had seen all kinds of crazy, violent, and horrible tragedies. But after having some time to really mull it over, I think I agree with him. The cops are supposed to protect us, and I think for the vast majority of them, it's exactly what they want to do when they wake up in the morning. But the idea that there are cops out there who aren't just ineffective or incompetent, but are actively covering up for dangerous and violent criminals, that's just about the most terrifying thing I can imagine. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 7 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams every Sunday and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over on my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks offered for the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, somebody, do something.